Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to
Fun About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey through all things fermented.
On Stitcher, iTunes, and archived right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org as well. We are pre-taping today due to scheduling time issues. We are very excited about today's episode. I don't even know where to start about how it came to be, but we are talking about Icelandic ferments and Perablot. Rachel, you helped set this up quite a bit.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I actually read our guest's article on an Icelandic Times website and thought it was super interesting. And we'll get into exactly what Thoriblot is and the traditions behind it and what it has to do with fermentation.
All right. So let's introduce our guest. So who do we have on the line right now?
We have Marie Valgardsson and Egdo. Is that correct?
Hello?
Can you guys hear us?
Yeah. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So why don't we have you guys introduce yourselves? So let's start with Marie first.
Okay. Well, I'm married to an Icelander, and I'm actually from New York originally, from Port Washington, where I grew up. And I've been living in Iceland for almost 9 years now.
Wow.
Okay.
And what do you do there?
Well, I do a lot of different things. One of my main jobs has been just writing for this magazine called Icelandic Times. And yes, that was me who wrote the Ugly Food Festival. Although I have to tell you the truth, that this was my boss who came up with that that title. And this is not like an Icelandic way of referring to Thorablot. That was a little bit our idea.
Oh.
Even though it is kind of ugly.
So let's dive right into that before we go into Egglo.
Let's introduce our second guest.
That's good. I take it back. Egglo.
I'm Egla Bergolofsdóttir. I am a food producer in Iceland. Me and my husband, we run an organic farm in East Iceland called Vallanes. And so I am a grower of barley, cereals, and vegetables, and a food producer. Yes, organic food producer.
Oh, excellent. So why don't we just jump into so tell us a bit about what is Thoriblot, first of all, to begin with. Since none of us in America are familiar at all with what it is at all.
Okay, who are you asking?
Let's go with Marie. Would that be an appropriate question for you?
Okay. All right. Okay, first thing, I thought maybe it would be nice to understand that it looks like it's written with a P, but actually that letter is pronounced like our English TH. Okay, so you don't call it Thoriblot, you call it Thoriblot, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's really great. So that's a first introduction to Icelandic pronunciation. So the thing about Thoriblot is that it actually is relatively a recent phenomenon, which was started in about right around the end of the 50s. Traditionally, Iceland has not been one to have, like, you know, a great restaurant scene way back, you know, until very recently. So back in the 50s, there were very few restaurants, and one restaurant owner thought it would be nice to get people into the restaurants, a little bit of marketing here, especially in January and February when it's really cold and dark and it's, you know, Christmas is over and, you know, not much to do. So he thought it would be a great idea to bring back some of these old foods that had been just starting to disappear, perhaps just a little bit, in the 50s and 60s. So he introduced the idea of these feasts, And, you know, the thing about the feast, sometimes people say, oh, it's the god of thunder, Thor, it's named after him. That's not really true. It's more a personification of the Winter King, you know, and it's also kind of a little bit of a maybe early anticipation of spring, just a little bit early. And so what they had was a variety of the old foods, which I guess we'll talk about, you know, later on, that were, you know, starting to disappear. And so this started off in Reykjavik, and then gradually the actual festival of Þorrablót actually spread right around the country, into every little community. And now it's a relatively big deal, that most people attend, and it's also accompanied with, of course, a lot of drinking, and but they also do little skits. So each community gathers up, you know, their best actors, and they perform little skits to perhaps make a little fun of some of the things that have happened in their community. So it's a great time of just fun and this old food and, you know, lots of brennivín and other drinks. So that's kind of how it is today.
And you, in terms of endearment, you called it the Ugly Food Festival in the article. What kind of ugly food or what kind of fermented foods do you see at this festival?
Okay. Well, the thing is, the reason we called it ugly food, and I'm afraid it's, you know, it's at least the visual, it's all very, very gray, right? It's just like, there's no blood in it. It's completely, practically devoid of color. And it's mostly, you know, meat dishes, fish dishes, that kind of thing. It's not actually dishes. It's just, you know, these trays, these wooden trays. So they have, what do they have? They have the fermented shark. They have dried fish. They serve whey-preserved whale blubber. Occasionally, you might see whey-preserved seal flippers. Then there's this hangikjöt, which is the smoked lamb. That's not preserved in whey or anything, but that's everyone loves that, and that's the traditional Christmas food as well. So that's on there. Then you've got various cuts of lamb that have been soured in whey. And then you've got also pressed lamb's testicles, preserved also in whey. And that's, that. Then we've got the halved sheep heads, either fresh. You've got a tray usually of the, not exactly fresh, but at least they haven't been preserved in whey. So kind of fresh. and then you've got head cheese as well. What else? You've got something called slaughter, which is actually blood pudding and liver sausage. And let me see, did I forget anything? I think that's kind of it.
Those are all pretty good and ugly. What I mean, so are these foods eaten throughout the year as well?
No. Well, some of them, yes. The hangikjöt, which is not fermented, like I said, that's served, that's been smoked with sheep dung, okay? That's got a very special taste. It doesn't taste like lamb anymore once it's been smoked with sheep dung. And I will say that when I first arrived, I didn't like it very much. My husband had such wonderful memories of it, and I was like, you know, hoping it just, wow, this is going to be so great, but I didn't like it when I first arrived. But now I love it. So it's a little bit of an acquired taste also. It's a very different kind of smoked taste, as you can imagine. It's nothing like what you know in America as smoked. Now, I want to say about the fermented shark. The fermented shark is I wouldn't call it a delicacy. There's a lot of misinformation around. I mean, I guess you could call it that, but not in any traditional sense of a, wow, this tastes so great, you know. This is, of course, these little cubes, and it's very, very strong. I've never tried it. I'm not planning on trying it. But, of course, it's definitely got its place, you know, in Icelandic, you know, culture and its history. But this is not something that the most people eat by any means. You couldn't even find it in the shops until very recently, on a year-round basis. Maybe you could go to the fish the fishmongers, the fish shops. Maybe you could find it there from time to time or something like that. But generally people don't eat it on any kind of a regular basis. And it's kind of just done for the amusement of tourists. So you just have to know that they're playing with you, and they'll tell you all these stories, like, yeah, this is what we eat. Well, haha, not really true.
And
the rest of it, pretty much, I would say, maybe the slaughter, the blood pudding, people do make their own still, a little bit. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it, yeah, a little bit, but generally people are not doing their own fermentation anymore.
Okay. Right. And I was reading the history of why of this fermented shark, and it's because these sharks actually are not edible fresh.
That's
they're poisonous.
Right.
They're toxic
right.
to humans, and so they're fermented in this way to make them edible. Even though, as you said, you know, it's definitely a very different, harsh kind of. There's a lot. What did I read? There was a lot of ammonia in it
right.
ammonia.
After it's fermented,
right.
so it's very stinky to the nose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But all of these foods.
This has just been, the modern day method is just to place it in these big tubs and it's pressed down and the ammonia, you know, seeps out. I think it's a couple of weeks. And then they let it dry in these open air sheds. They you know, but it has to be, there's only one guy who does it, way up in the west part of Iceland who does it.
But these were all foods that were eaten in Iceland at one time.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Cool.
Yeah. Just depends on, you know, because you have to remember that it was very, very poor. It was very oppressed by the Danes and Norwegians, and people were starving. And then there was, you know, volcanic eruptions that wiped out a third of the people. And so they were definitely on full-scale, you know, survival mode for 1,000 years, basically.
And then I also was reading, this is some of these dishes are kind of eaten in celebration of Icelandic independence and
right.
Icelandic pride.
Yes, well, yeah, this is the thing. Around the turn of the century, from what I've read, is there were a couple of Icelanders who were going to university in Denmark, and they were starting to, you know, there was talk. Of course, you know, this is over maybe, you know, a couple of decades. People are starting to talk about independence and, you know, how can we get free? And so they started to do a little bit of this kind of, you know, celebration as just a point of national pride, you know, to just get the ball rolling with the independence, which didn't actually happen until 1945, I think it is.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you.
Actually, I want to roll back a little bit. So we were talking before. You mentioned that a lot of the fermentations are done in whey. And mm-hmm. we on the show, we've actually been talking a bit about how we need to use a bit more whey. So is traditionally in Iceland, is whey used a lot as like a preservative or to ferment
right.
things?
I'm gonna speak a little bit about that, and then I think we can turn it over to Eglo,
yeah.
because she knows quite a bit. But just, yeah, you know, the whey was a huge product here because of the skyr. And we really need to talk about skyr at some point, because that's the whole reason why there's so much whey, because it's a product, you know, from making skyr.
Right, the Icelandic yogurt, right?
Because there was no really salt here, because there were no forests, so they couldn't, you know, boil down the seawater to make salt. So they were very scarce, you know, salt was very scarce as well. So this was the absolute perfect solution, was to ferment in whey, which, you know, was just running out their ears, basically. And it was even a drink. Fermented whey was used as a refreshing drink on the farms, you know. And I mean, it's very healthy stuff, and I suppose until, you know, Coca-Cola came and took over here, this is what people drank. Then Coca-Cola came, and then everybody started getting addicted.
That's great. We're starting to embrace whey a little bit as a drink here, but actually, before we go to Igloo, we're going to take a quick break.
We'll be right back with more Icelandic fermentations.
Back to Ferment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're here in the studio on the phone with Mary Valgardsson and also Eglio, whose last name I don't remember. And it's very hard to pronounce.
Oh my God. Our poor American tongues have a hard time with Icelandic pronunciation.
We are talking about Icelandic foods, cultures, and fermentations, and are just getting to fermented vegetables and the processes of fermenting and the kind of the scene that's going on in Iceland. Eglo?
Can you hear us?
Yes.
So let's talk about actually what you make as far as fermenting goes. What would you like to start with?
Well, me personally, the only thing I ferment at the moment is vegetables.
Mm-hmm. So what kinds of vegetables are you growing and fermenting?
I'm sorry?
What kind of vegetables are you growing and fermenting?
Well, in this farm, we grow up to 100 varieties of vegetables. So we are very motivated to, you know, explore different ways of preserving. And especially now that we have learned how, the health benefits of fermented vegetables, they are tremendous. And but we cultivate, let's say, we vegetables in Iceland, they came late. It's but actually one of the Vatanes farm, our farm, was probably one of the first places in Iceland where potatoes were grown, for example. Mm-hmm. And potatoes and turnips, they started in Iceland in the late 18th century and then onwards. And so we stick to those varieties, old varieties of Icelandic potatoes, Icelandic turnips. And then we have added, of course, cabbage, kale, lettuce, many, many different kinds. But the main for fermentation, it's basically all cabbage and root vegetables that you can use, and those are the basis for our line, which is now like 7-8 different types of fermented vegetables. And so we do a sauerkraut the traditional way, but we are also experimenting and using the other vegetables that grow well in Iceland, like turnips and kale. And kohlrabi, and then we add spices. So we make different recipes for different purposes.
Oh. And then do you sell those locally?
We sell them locally, but also internationally a little bit. We have started to export, but the local market is the main market.
And then do you use traditional spices for those ferments, or do you find that... Do you have some local spices or combinations that people like particularly?
Well, we use like caraway, which is quite a Nordic, typical flavor for the Nordic region, and also dill. But we also, you know, we like to experiment. So we use turmeric and we use ginger for our turnips. And but we're going to keep on, you know, developing different flavors, but let's say it's mainly a question of, I mean, encourage people to eat more vegetables, and so we use different spices, whatever makes it flavorful and intriguing.
Awesome. Now, can you talk a little bit about skyr?
Yes, talking about traditional Icelandic food, I'm involved in slow food quite a bit as well, and have been for the last 15 years. We established a division of slow food in Iceland in 2001. So, and slow food is actually one of the networks that is promoting fermented traditional Icelandic food at the moment. It's the And skyr is quite influential when we talk about Icelandic traditional food, and especially the kind of skyr that we promote in slow food is traditional, the traditional way of making skyr, as they were making it in the farms ever since the settlement. So by definition, skyr is a cheese. It was produced in all the Nordic area about the time of the settlement, but somehow it disappeared in the Nordic countries except in Iceland. So we have been making this food ever since the settlement in the 9th century.
Wow.
And yes. So I mean, there is. The key element in making skyr at the farms is that you're using live bacteria that is coming from a previous batch of skyr. So it has, as you're probably aware, people are rediscovering the importance of food bacteria for the digestion and health. And so this traditional product delivers that partly as well. And of course, it supplied us with whey, which was the key ingredient in preserving foods like the foramadur we were talking about before.
Now, what can you tell us a little different? So we actually do have a skyr producer in New York City, Siggy's.
Yeah.
But for those out there, what is the difference between skyr and like yogurt that we might find, more traditional yogurt that we might find in this country?
Yeah, well, you have to be careful when you talk about skyr. Of course, there are industrial ways of making it, and then there is the traditional way,
mm-hmm. Okay.
which is the traditional way to make it. And as this is, let's say, the traditional skyr is a product with live bacteria, so that it will always reflect where it's coming from. It will reflect the kind of milk you use, the place it was produced in, and the environment. So even in Iceland, you have different flavors depending on where it's coming from. And so I am not familiar with skyr, which is, or something similar that is made in the U.S. It's never going to compare to the skyr that is made in this country. So in Iceland, we have done tastings with different traditional skyrs made from different producers, but they're using exactly the same way of making it, and it will taste completely different from one farm to another, because the bacteria, as I said, this is live food, and it will always reflect where it's coming from.
Now, one thing I know, the difference. Now, when you make skyr, do you make it at room temperature, or do you have to heat it? Do the bacteria work at warmer temperatures?
Well, you would take milk, you would heat it up to a certain level, you would let it cool again, and then you would add the skyr from a previous batch, which has to start the culture.
Right.
So it's a two day process.
And now, then after you add the live cultures, do they leave the skyr at room temperature, or do they keep it in a heated?
No, it goes down to maybe a little warmer than room temperature.
Okay. Because I think that's one difference, is that I bought skyr here, and it's you can propagate it. You know, I can use a little bit of the skyr I buy here, or yogurt, for instance, to make new batches. But the skyr you have to do at room temperature, whereas yogurt you have to actually keep it a little warmer at around 108 to 109 degrees.
Fahrenheit.
But sorry.
There are different bacteria. You know that the bacteria. Key bacteria in traditional Icelandic skyr are not the same.
Right, exactly.
Yep.
So then tell us, how do people eat skyr there? What do people do with it?
Well, basically, you would use it in a similar way as yogurt. So most people use it as in between meals, or even as a breakfast. And it's also, as the traditional one is quite rich in flavor, it has a very, let's say, complex interesting flavor. It's also used in the restaurants for desserts. But most people, I guess, on a day-to-day basis would be using it like yogurt, so adding a little bit of berry or fruit to sweeten it a little bit. And yes. use it in a similar way.
Great. And then, tell us what other fermented foods are popular in Iceland, or are people fermenting and eating or drinking?
Drinking. Yes, well, the skyr, of course, is quite popular. Well, the shark, for obvious reasons, being a very interesting food. But it's mainly for, you know, certain celebrations or, you know, in the period of Thorri, for example. And also, you know, to surprise the tourists.
Right. I'm fascinated with the sheep's head in Wei.
Oh, yeah. Tell us a bit about the sheep's head in Wei.
Yeah, the sheep's head have also been preserved in Wei, and that goes for most of the Saramatas. You would have the fresh version and the version that has been preserved in Wei.
A fresh version?
It's not really that difficult to make. You just boil it.
Right.
Oh.
And then you just place it in the Wei, or you serve it fresh. A half of a sheep's head. You can buy those in the shops.
Right.
You see, you don't have to go and butcher your own lamb, you know. Mm-hmm. You can just buy these already, you know, prepared or fresh, you know, from the butcher. Yeah.
But the lamb testicles.
You can get these things. You can get the blood. You can, in the fall, you can buy liters of fresh blood. So you can make the slaughter, the blood pudding, which people do, you see.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Or you can buy the lamb's testicles too,
right?
which I have seen as well. They're, you know, sitting there.
Right. What about fermented beverages? Do people are people home brewing or making wine or other kind of beverages like that there?
In the household,
as far as
no,
I know, people are not. Generally, people are not doing it themselves. The average person is not doing this, but there are starting to be new producers ever since the financial crisis in 2008. You're starting to have a whole new breed of these new food producers that are coming out on the market now. You've got a really nice away drink flavored with blueberries, for instance.
Ooh.
Yeah, which is very, very nice, really refreshing. But there's like, now we have a market, you see. And this is very interesting because, you know, years ago, there were no markets here. There was no, you couldn't go like in Italy or in France and just go down and, you know, this, go to the market and buy fresh this, that, and the other. It just didn't exist until about 5 years ago. And that's only in Reykjavik. And the little towns don't have markets either. So this is all kind of really sad, you know, that it's sort of come to that. You know, you have just big conglomerates that would, well, big, you know, comparatively, you know, that would do this, do that. And then the little people were not allowed to. But now, you see, with the financial crash, this has been really great because they've seen the need, you know, that people want to not, because otherwise we had to import everything here, you know. So now it's like opening up the way for new producers. And I guess even you, Eglo, you haven't been doing this for how long? For too long, have you? How long have you been in business?
No, the farm has been around for a long time. My husband started in 1979. But our business has transformed. And let's say, after the economic crisis, we started to look inwards a little bit and taking a look in our garden and see what we could do and how we could develop food we took back old methods and it has just been a tremendous incentive for the creative food producers. And so slow food also gained momentum after the crisis. And and of course, please remember the economy basically, well, it collapsed.
Right.
And so did the currency. And all of a sudden, it was possible to produce and increase food processing in Iceland. Things that had not been viable before were all of a sudden viable because of the exchange rate that is completely different today. So a lot of food producers have been created in the last few years after the crisis. This was one of the industries that have gained momentum after the crisis. So definitely, we are not doing the same things today as before 2008. There's a new opportunity now for food producers.
That's great.
I've heard there are a few new breweries in the country as well. Eglo, you said you make barley. Has any of your barley been malted and sent to any local breweries? And is anybody brewing with local barley that you know of?
Brewing, making beer. I'm sorry?
Brewing, making beer with local barley?
Yep, brewing, black beer.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, there are a few. Yes, there are some breweries coming up, and there are breweries using local barley. Also, there is now a whiskey producer using barley, and they are also making gin. So, yes, this is definitely something that is coming as well.
I'm curious, what kind of, if you could just tell us a little bit of what kind of events and other activities is Slow Food having in Iceland?
Well, it's the markets, of course. It's, for example, the Harper Market. There is also, I mean, just a lot of networking and let's say, try to influence authorities and there are events maybe 3-4 times a year which promote, you know, traditional food and things like that. There's a lot of also with restaurants and then of course we organize projects together with Slow Food internationally during the Salone del Gusto and the Terra Madre networks.
Great.
Wow. Yeah. And then another thing is, maybe you've heard about the Arc of Taste and the Presidium projects with Slow Foods, which is basically registering traditional foods on the Arc of Taste and promoting them through the Slow Food Network. Mm-hmm. Presidia is another project that encourages producers to be a part of the Presidia and get promotional tools through Slow Food. So these kind of projects have taken more space in the last few years.
Excellent.
There's a good movement towards the attention of local produce and more care and people understanding what they're eating and where they're getting it from.
Absolutely. It's always, you know, educating people really about the importance and trying to encourage more producers to become hands-on in making the food.
Mm-hmm. There is a movement to start homebrewing a lot more in the country, although I'm not sure what the laws are like over there. I'm actually going to visit you guys in May. I'm being flown out to talk about off flavors in beer and help run a homebrew competition, so it should be very fun. And I hope I get to meet you guys.
Yeah,
that would be great. We would love to meet you.
May 5th. See you then.
Well, thank you both for being with us. It's super exciting. I definitely want to go to Iceland and do a skier tasting now.
Yeah.
Yes. I love yogurt, so, and I've obviously never been to Iceland and tasted real skier. Icelandic skier, so that would be amazing.
I'll fill you in on it, Mary. I'm going to have some skier, some lamb testicles, some sheep's head, some fermented shark.
Some Renovan, too.
Some Renovan.
If you come in January.
Yeah.
That's the time.
That's the time for all of that. It's warming. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah.
And joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
It has been quite enlightening.
Yeah. Great.
Where can we find out? Where can we find more of Eglo? More about your farm.
Well, if you go to vatlanes.is.
And how do you spell that?
How do you spell that?
VALANES .is, and you can find all information about our farm. We are open in the summer, so please come and visit.
All right.
Awesome.
And Marie, where can we find more information about you? And you do an Icelandic food tour, correct?
Right. I'm doing food tours in the south part of Iceland, just outside of the capital. And I basically take people on a bit of a cultural, historic food journey through this part of Iceland. And we take a look at some geothermal cooking. We go to a turf farm where you'll get little tiny bites. They've done a beautiful job of offering little bites of all of this food that we're talking about, the Þóramatr. They serve little bites of this food, so that's one way that you can be introduced to this food. You get a beautiful tour of the turf farm, how the people used to live. And then we go basically from the past to the present, and then we start gradually, moving up to more of the new Nordic cuisine. And so we basically have a cultural, historic food tour in a couple of hours. And, of course, surrounded by all the magnificent scenery. So I think it's one of the best ways to see Iceland is with a tour like this, frankly.
How often do you hold those?
Yeah.
That is eatiniceland.com. Yeah, right. That's okay. My website, eatiniceland.com.
Fantastic.
That sounds amazing, and I would love to do that one day.
I will see you there.
Yes. Hope you can come on it. That would be so fantastic.
Awesome. Well, cheers. Thanks again, and we'll be back next Monday for more Fummin About It.
Fummin About It.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.